From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This week, President Trump asked in a tweet, by the way, if Russia was working so hard in the 2016 election, it all took place during the Obama admin, why didn't they stop them? Well, today's Washington Post reports on what the Obama administration did and did not do to punish Russia for its interference in the 2016 election. It's an extremely detailed report. We'll link you at herenow.org. But Greg Miller, national security correspondent for the Post and one of the reporters on the piece, joins us for the headlines. Hi, Greg.
Hi. How are you?
Good. And you quote one former senior Obama administration official saying, I feel like we sort of choked. And others who say they were in an impossible position, starting with they didn't want to be perceived as trying to influence the election by pointing out what Russia was doing. What do you think? Did Obama choke?
I mean, I think they ended up getting tied up in knots quite a bit. And I think a lot of the people we talked to would admit that at this point.
Yeah.
And they were tied up by a number of factors. I mean, some of them, all of them are legitimate, I think. But their response or the way they tried to navigate this minefield, it couldn't be questioned. I think they were legitimately worried before the election about an escalation. If they act, if they punish Russia, does Russia come back even harder and really mess up Election Day, for example? That was a real worry.
Right. Well, tell us a little bit more about what the administration was seeing. Fake news stories, but also requests for visas.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of new detail in the story about other things we didn't know at the time that were causing alarm for national security officials. One of those things was a flurry of an unusual spike in the number of requests from Moscow for temporary visas for its officials to be in the United States before the election. A lot of these requests for people who had technical skills or technical training, supposedly to go to work at Russian missions in the United States, but the FBI kind of freaked out. What are these people all trying to get into this country for? And asked and got the State Department to kind of slow roll those requests to make sure that most of them didn't get through.
Yeah, and of course there were also the attacks, the hacking attacks on the Democratic Party. But as former Secretary of Homeland Security Jay Johnson told the House Intelligence Committee this week, once the Obama administration started getting this intelligence and an explosive CIA intelligence report that arrived at the White House in August and pretty much came out and said Russia is trying to interfere with our election. He, Jay Johnson, tried to warn state election officials. He was met with reactions that, you write, ranged from neutral to negative. Georgia Secretary of State still says he doesn't believe it. And then administration officials went to congressional leaders, and that meeting divided along party lines.
Yeah, they ran into opposition and obstacles at almost every turn. They made a real effort to try to get to Republicans to sign on to statements condemning Moscow's interference and urging state election officials and systems to get help, make sure their systems were secure. And Republicans wanted no part of this. I mean, it really did become bogged down in politics in a very disturbing and disheartening way.
Yeah. Well, when the administration did decide to issue a public statement in October and let the public know, about Russia's attempts to interfere in the election, which was upcoming, but having interfered in the during the campaign, this was, I think you write, issued this statement at 3:30, and then at 4 o'clock, your paper broke the story of the Access Hollywood tapes, completely drowning the administration's announcement.
Yeah, it was almost as if they really couldn't catch a break here. So they finally bring themselves to issue a statement. For the first time, the Obama administration is going to say something publicly about what it knows about what Russia is up to. They release it. Half an hour later, the Access Hollywood tape breaks on the Washington Post website. It drowns almost everything else out. And then a half an hour later after that, WikiLeaks puts out its first dump of emails from John Podesta's email account. I mean, it just was an avalanche that day.
Well, what about after the election? The Obama administration still in power. And you talk about them planting cyber weapons in Russia's infrastructure. These are the digital equivalent of something that can be detonated, you know, if the U.S. does find that Moscow is escalating, this sort of cyber attack. Tell us more about that and what has happened to that cyber weapon infrastructure.
Right. So when Obama finally does act and impose some punishment on Moscow in late December, there are a number of measures that they announce. They're going to expel 35 Russians from the United States. They're going to close some compounds. They announce some economic sanctions. But the most intriguing thing they do is not announced. It is hidden. It is that Obama has secretly approved this covert classified program authorizing his intelligence agencies to start planting cyber weapons across Russian infrastructure, things that could be detonated down the road if the United States gets in an exchange with Moscow. And the weird thing here, the strange thing, is that it will take time for this capability to be put in place. So it would be up to the Trump administration whether any of that ever gets used.
And, of course, the Trump administration and President Trump in particular has said he doesn't quite believe that there even was this interference. Greg Miller.
Has no inclination of following up on any of these punitive measures.
Greg Miller, national security correspondent for The Washington Post, and you can read Obama's Secret Struggle to Punish Russia for Putin's Election Assault at herenow.org. Greg, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, in France, hundreds of refugees have returned to Calais, just across the English Channel from the UK. A refugee camp there had been closed last year by the French authorities, but refugees are desperate to get to the UK, and they are back. Joining us now is the BBC's Hugh Schofield in Paris. Hugh, this camp was closed, destroyed, basically. How can people still be using it?
Well, I'm not sure we can say they're returning exactly to where the camp was. I mean, the jungle, so-called, was a very specific area just to the north of Calais on sort of dunes and rough land near the beach. Installations developed, and there were tents, and then there were more permanent buildings, et cetera, et cetera. That's all gone, and the people who are returning aren't really there. I mean, they're thereabouts, but they're living in much rougher circumstances, moving from day to day to different bits, different pictures and so on. It's not a specific area. It's much more sort of diffuse now.
And the reason that they're going to Calais is because they want to go to the UK. Is there any way for them to do that once they get to Calais?
Well, the reason they're going to Calais is the same reason they've been going to Calais for the last 20 years. They and their, well, you know, people who could be their parents. I mean, you know, I've been covering this for 20 years. It's the pull of Britain for all the reasons that we've talked about many, many times. The language, the greater, the freer economy, the fact that you can sort of slip in and sort of hide better because there's no identity cards, they have family members, et cetera, et cetera. One has to assume, in fact, we know that they do succeed. I mean, it may take them weeks and months to get through, but there are people who help them do that for money, and eventually many of them do get through. If they didn't, then there wouldn't be this constant pull to the channel. That said, it can take many, many goes. It can mean waiting for weeks and months. It can mean paying a lot of money, and it can be very, very dangerous indeed, but that doesn't deter them.
What's the overall situation with refugees at this point in Europe? We haven't heard like we did last summer with people, you know, marching across the continent trying to get into some of the richer countries.
Well, I mean, that's mainly because this deal with Turkey seems to be holding. I mean, if you remember, a year ago, there was the big movement of people out of Turkey to Greece and then up through the Balkans and so on. And they were largely Syrians, but not just Syrians. And there's this huge pressure, which eventually was broken when Angela Merkel said that she would accept this very large number. And then again, with the reaction against that, there was the deal with Turkey, so that Turkey would hold back and discourage people crossing to the islands from Turkey to Greece. And the people would be kind of kept in camps there and so on. And that relieved an awful lot of the pressure, though, of course, it does leave Europe now slightly in hock to Turkey. There is still pressure coming up from the south, though. The boats across from Libya to Italy still come, maybe not in quite the same numbers as last year and the year before, but, you know, still tens of thousands so far this year. And that means, as far as France is concerned, that there is pressure coming up from Italy across the Italian border. And then, you know, we see the visible sign of this where the logjam is. And the logjam is Calais, because that's where they all want to leave from for the UK. So the fact that there are now 400, 500, 600 people building up at Calais is a sign that there are people arriving in France and heading up there.
And what is French President Emmanuel Macron saying about all of this? Must be an early challenge for his administration.
It is going to be a challenge for him because, of course, he's styles himself as somebody who's very practically minded, but also someone who's broadly on the left and has a humanitarian conscience and believes that France has a duty in that regard. All he said is, you know, rather grandly, that France needs to show its humanitarian instincts in all this matter. But, I mean, of course, that leaves huge room for interpretation. And I noticed that the Interior Minister, Gérard Collomb, who's just been up to Calais today, has said that from his his point of view, the humanitarian thing is not to open a camp. I mean, you know, what the government believes is humanitarian is, in fact, having a bigger plan, one that would, you know, solve this issue on the European scale, which would mean making sure that there are places in France where these people can be looked after, but away from Calais, and that on the larger scale, there are systems in place so that if somebody arrives in France from another country, he will be taken back to that other country, because under the rules, asylum seekers are supposed to seek asylum in the first country they come to in Europe. These are the rules that have been there for years, of course, but they've never been properly applied.
That's the BBC's Hugh Schofield joining us from Paris to talk about the refugees who have returned to Calais in France. Hugh, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Today, Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul, who's against the new version of a health care bill from Republican senators because he said it still doesn't go far enough in repealing what's known as Obamacare, he called for his dream bill.
What I would like to do is legalize inexpensive insurance, and you should be able to get insurance for a dollar a day.
Rand Paul speaking on MSNBC's Morning Joe. His words and others in the news are ricocheting through social media. So let's take a look with Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. He joins us from Washington. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Robbie.
Talk about what you're noticing online. First, images of some protesters yesterday trying to get the attention of senators flying to their home districts. What happened?
Protests at Ronald Reagan International Airport, also known as DCA, partly because of what Topper Spiro actually tweeted out to his 35,000 followers. This is what he said. Everyone in the DC metro area, there will be a protest at DCA Airport as senators fly home. So the senators going home yesterday evening would have seen, if they're going through that airport, banners saying things like, don't take away our health care. We shouldn't have to beg you not to literally kill us. There was even a confrontation or conversation with Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, where one protester was having a conversation with him about, should you vote for this new healthcare legislation, trying to persuade him. I looked through Senator Grassley's Twitter feed. I found nothing on that confrontation.
But what might you be seeing from people on the right side of the political spectrum?
On the right, in the camp of President Trump, underneath his tweets, vaguely supporting this new healthcare legislation, things like, get over it, liberals, you lost, and hashtag make America great again.
Okay, there's that. But you also saw questions about healthcare itself online. What are people asking?
There's a way that Google can track exactly what we're looking for, what we're searching for, and they compile all of that information into something called Google Trends. So in the last 24 hours, and in fact, all of this week, they were looking to see what Americans didn't know about this new healthcare legislation, quite a lot until about yesterday. And so the top three questions Americans were asking on Google: how many Republican senators voted for the healthcare bill? That was number one. Question number two, which senators are working on the healthcare bill? Question number three, really interesting. Which country has the best healthcare? Now, the answers are linked to other stories and other links. So you might not necessarily get a direct answer, but you can see what other people are sharing, what other news stories are out there that might go along with your query.
And we should say there are queries, because this was a bill that was crafted in secret by a small group of Republican senators. Even some, you know, moderate Republicans are upset about not having input, and they haven't voted on it yet. It just kind of, they just got to see the draft yesterday. So everybody's seeing it for the first time. So questions there. Femi, we need a fun story, and you have one for us out of the UK, which could use a fun story. It's gone viral. This is about, you might see the picture of teenage boys at the, it looks like ISCA Academy in Exeter. Came to
wearing
skirts.
Yes. I don't want to spoil it. You tell me. Yeah, came to school in skirts. Why would they come to school in skirts? They actually look great in skirts. I think they actually look better than some of the girls. They were told, it's been really hot in the UK over the last couple of days. They were told that despite the heat, they could not wear shorts to school. No policy for shorts, no shorts in the school uniform. And one of the teachers said, as a throwaway, well, wear a skirt. The next day, five of the lads turned up wearing school skirts that normally the girls wear, and then more and more turned up in the following days. And of course, fantastic photographs all being shared online, and people were saying, these kids, they know how to protest for social justice. I think it was kind of quite tongue-in-cheek. The boys did say that it was quite nice and breezy wearing skirts. I do not think this will be a permanent look for their school uniform, but the school is definitely looking at perhaps incorporating shorts into their school summer uniform.
Well, the Scots wear them all the time.
Of course. Nothing wrong with a good skirt.
We want to get to the news from Mark Zuckerberg, who announced his new mission statement for Facebook. What was the old one? What's the new one?
Well, this has never happened before. Facebook has never changed their mission statement. So the original one was to give people the power to share and make the world more open and connected. That sounds incredibly reasonable. But sharing what? Are they sharing flawed content? Are they sharing hate speech? So the new mission statement is very specific. And this is what Mark Zuckerberg said. He said he wants to give people the power to build community and bring the world closer together. So he's focusing on the positivity of connecting and communities. And you may be thinking, well, how on earth is he going to do that? And Facebook are looking at the Facebook communities around the world, particularly in the US, who are diverse, who have missions to actually help people come together, and focusing on him. In fact, he made this change in Facebook's policy in Chicago at the very first Facebook Community Summit, which was a collection of 300 different Facebook administrators from groups all coming together saying, we can do better. We can speak to each other in meaningful ways and connect in positive ways.
We're going to have a thought on that in a minute. But we want to note first a story that involves you. We've been covering the standoff between Qatar and its neighbors, including Saudi Arabia, countries that cut off diplomatic ties with Qatar earlier this month over allegations that the country funds terrorism. But also, yesterday, Saudi Arabia and other countries released a list of demands for Qatar, and one of them is for the country to close its state-run broadcaster, Al Jazeera. Now, you work for Al Jazeera English, part of Al Jazeera. The acting managing director there told the AP that the demand was nothing but an attempt to muzzle a voice of democracy in the region, suppress freedom of expression, and the network is committed to continuing our usual comprehensive and impartial coverage of events around the world. Can you comment on this story?
So, Robin, my pay grade is a one, and the person qualified to comment on this story's pay grade is, let's say, 50. So you can see my dilemma here. So I will find you a 50, and I will give you a comment for that. But for now, I will leave you with the coverage that I know NPR is actually doing on this story.
Yeah. All right. Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English, which still is there right now. Femi, thank you.
I might see you next week.
Femi, thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Well, we mentioned Facebook having maybe a negative impact, and it's high school reunion season, and maybe Facebook is having an impact there. If you Google school reunions, you'll see articles back to 2011 talking about the demise of reunions. You know, why travel miles and spend a lot of money when you can see friends on Facebook? But now there might be a new wrinkle, what people are saying on Facebook. We heard about this from one of our favorite listeners, Tom Girding, owner of Davison's Bacon and Sausage Works in Davison, Michigan. His graduating class there had 1,500 years ago. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
I'm good. And so you wanted to tell me about how your 40-year class reunion was last weekend. Now, born in Flint, but raised in Davison. So this is your hometown.
That's correct.
That's right. And you were having your 40th year class reunion last weekend, and you started calling people beforehand. What'd you find?
Well, a lot of people, like you said, why go to it? We have Facebook, you know, kind of sarcastic. But and then I started hearing from people that said, well, I'd be embarrassed to show my face there after everything that I had said during the campaign. And I heard from another camp that said, you know what? I lost a lot of respect for half of my friends. I don't want to see them anymore.
And lost a lot of respect because what? Finish that thought. Because of what?
The vitriol during the campaigns. You know, as a small business owner, rule number one is don't get involved in politics. I mean, you just can't afford to. So I sat back and just kind of watched as a spectator. I was just amazed at the vitriol and the name calling. And I even had one really good friend make a call to arms. You know, and this was like 2 months before the elections.
And this was all playing out on Facebook. So you told me you called about 10 or 12 classmates, and people were saying, as you said, well, I'm in touch with people, so why do I need to go? But a large number of people saying, I don't want to go because I'm embarrassed of what I said, and I don't want to go because I don't like what I read.
Exactly. Wow. Or I'm not your friend anymore.
Wow.
I even talked to one gal that now lives down in Florida. I contacted her to find out if she was coming up for the reunion. And she said, heck no, I can't show my face in that town anymore in public.
Wow. You know,
so that's, Robin, there is a tear in the social fabric in this country that I think goes a lot deeper than anybody realizes.
Well, this is what you wondered. Are other people feeling this? We'll do a shout out and see. But so what happened? You had a class of 1,500. How many showed up?
Well, actually, the organizers of the reunion, I think a week or so beforehand, were getting a little bit nervous. So they opened it up and made it an all-alumni reunion, which includes anybody that basically is old enough to drink because it was held in a festival beer tent that had graduated from Davison High School. And the turnout was just paltry.
Tell me.
Maybe 30, 35 people.
No.
Yeah. None of mine were there.
This has got to feel pretty sad.
Yeah, what I'm more worried about is are we going to be able to sew the hole back up at any point? Because it doesn't seem to be getting much better. You know, we are all grown-ups. I think we need to start acting like it. There was a time before social media where you just did not walk around talking about politics, you know, wearing your heart on your sleeve, but that's all changed.
Yeah. Look, 40 years, you know, who knows if you're going to see these people again.
I don't know. I guess there's a lot of people just content with Facebook and they think it's a daily class reunion.
What would a face-to-face meeting with some of these people mean to you?
A lot more than something on Facebook.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing like a good handshake or a hug or a kiss.
Yeah.
You can't do that on your telephone.
No.
Not yet.
Yeah. Well, Tom Girding, again, owner of Davison's Bacon and Sausage Works, nitrate free in Davison, Michigan, a longtime listener. Thanks for letting us know about this.
Next time you're near Flint, you better stop.
I will.
Okay, Robin.
Okay.
Thank you.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
As Republicans try to gain more support for the health care bill passed yesterday, or released yesterday rather, there are a lot of questions today about how it would impact consumers, hospitals, and the drug industry. As of now, a major pharmaceutical trade association has not taken a position on the bill, but rolling back Medicaid coverage is expected to hurt the industry's sales. Carrie Geiger of Bloomberg News joins us from New York. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. And tell us more about what provisions in this bill would impact the drug industry.
Well, the drug industry, just going back to Obamacare, was relatively unscathed by how Obamacare and, well, the ACA was set up. It's unclear exactly what the Senate bill is going to do. We know for sure that they want to roll back Medicare, which will impact
Medicaid
companies. However, the biggest loser for that rollback is going to be hospitals and healthcare stocks rather than the pharma industry. The pharma industry looks like it has a lot of advocates within the Trump administration, and this bill kind of leaves them alone largely.
Well, Moody's Investor Services estimates that Medicaid is responsible for 10% of spending on drugs in the U.S. So I would imagine that the drug industry would not want to see cuts to Medicaid, at least from the perspective of their bottom line.
It's very well that could be the case. It'll be interesting to see what position they come out on. You know, they have a lot of negotiating power with healthcare centers and hospitals on how drugs are priced. So they could change the formula on that to make up for it. So it'll be interesting to see how the business model is tweaked to ensure that some of those cuts don't eat into their profits, which, as we know, it's an incredibly profitable industry.
Yes. And President Trump has been very critical of that during the campaign, of the drug industry, for high prices and rising prices. This week, we got news of a draft order from the White House on the industry. What's in it?
So the draft order was you know, pretty interesting news. You know, of course, as you said, Trump basically said last January that the industry is getting away with murder and he was going to come down hard on drug companies with pricing. The draft order, though, looks to be a way to relieve regulations that basically the people that put this together see as kind of holding pharma companies back rather than a direct attack on drug prices. So these are things that the drug industry has largely asked for or would, you know, essentially champion. It could be like the easing of federal programs requiring pharmaceutical companies to give discounts to hospitals serving low-income patients. That could be helpful to their business model. It's also looking at value-based agreements, and this is where pharmaceutical companies and insurers agree to pay for drugs based, essentially on how well they work and their effectiveness, which is also an industry-backed proposal. So this draft order, you know, really seems to be working in favor for the drug industry, very different from, of course, what Trump said in January.
Yeah, he's been talking about getting the U.S. to be able to negotiate drug prices down. Doesn't sound like that's what this does at all.
No, it you know, it's going back to this whole issue of regulation. And, you know, regulation is a word that is thrown around by you know, both sides of the campaigns during the president's election on easing regulations to help business. It's never entirely clear what those regulations are or what you need to get rid of, but it doesn't look like drug pricing is going to be under siege anytime soon.
That's Carrie Geiger of Bloomberg News. Carrie, thanks.
Thank you.
And it's been a week now since Minnesota police officer Geronimo Yanez was acquitted in the shooting death of 32-year-old Philando Castile after a traffic stop in July of last year. You all remember the aftermath of the shooting was live-streamed on Facebook by Castile's girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, who was sitting in the passenger seat, her toddler daughter in the back seat. Even the governor of Minnesota, Mark Dayton, asked, would this have happened if Castile and his passengers were white? Last Tuesday, 4 days after last Friday's verdict, investigators released a dashboard video from the officer's squad car, the first time it's been shown outside the courtroom. It's very difficult to watch. It shows Officer Yanez approaching Castile's car, politely telling him his brake lights are out, calmly asking for his license and insurance. Castile passes what appears to be an insurance paper. We're going to play what happens next, and a warning, this is difficult for some unbearable to listen to. Castile begins, quietly and calmly telling the officer he has a gun.
Sir, I have to tell you, I do have a firearm on me.
Don't reach for it, then.
Don't pull it out.
Don't pull it out.
In the trial, Officer Yanez said he feared for his life, thinking that Philando Castile was reaching for the gun. His girlfriend testified he was reaching for his wallet for the identification he'd been asked for. John Thompson worked with Philando Castile. Philando was a popular lunchroom worker. John, a mechanic who worked on Philando's lunchroom equipment in St. Paul's Public Schools. And John joins us now, and I'm imagining that this shooting has been difficult to watch.
Yeah, I saw Philando on the 4th of July, and then I saw him on Facebook Live on the 6th of July, and I didn't know it was him. I mean, I'm getting ready for work in the morning, and then I see his name across the screen of the television, and then I see the images that Diamond, because I didn't even pay attention to whose Facebook feed it was. I just saw it, and it was like numbing to me, but when I saw his name, I screamed, oh, my God, that's Phil. Oh, wow.
So you saw the Facebook live streaming first from Diamond Reynolds that we all saw, and then you had to see that dashboard video that we just played a little bit of. And I understand you saw that in the courtroom sitting with Philando's mother.
You can't show...
Oh.
You can't show emotion in the courtroom. Oh, wow. You can't show emotion in the courtroom, so I had to sit and watch it. I tried to hurry up and go to the family room, and they wouldn't open the door fast enough, man. So
obvious that was horrible in the courtroom because you couldn't express the emotion that you just did, which is understandable. Look, a couple questions. Philando had a permit to carry that gun. He's required to tell an officer he has it. Many people thought he did tell him he had the permit. But as we just heard on that tape, he only was able to get out that he had the gun. You know, Officer Yanez's lawyer, Earl Gray, says that was key to the case. He told the Twin Cities Pioneer Press that, you know, without that video, people wouldn't have known that Castile didn't say he had a permit. How do you feel about that? That just the idea that a lot of people thought, why didn't, you know, he say he had a permit for it? But others have said, well, why would you tell someone you have a gun if you're going to shoot them? I mean, you know.
Type of man says, officer, I must warn you, I have a firearm. I'm warning you before I kill you. Like, what type of man does that?
Yeah. Officer Yanez was fired just after he was acquitted. His supporters had a page to raise money for his family. He's not working right now. That page was taken down because of complaints. His family says they're praying for Philando Castile's family. Do you have any sympathy for an officer? I mean, it seems to me that both innocent gun owners and officers are put in an impossible situation. If you're required to tell an officer you have a gun, then the officer is immediately nervous about the gun. I mean, do you have any sympathy that it felt like such an impossible situation?
No. I definitely don't have any sympathy for the scared police officer, because you can't be a scared Marine. You can't be a scared U.S. serviceman. And you actually asked to be an officer. You swore under oath that you would uphold the law. So, no.
Look, who did we lose in Philando Castile?
Man, I'm glad you got to that question. Mm-hmm. Listen, on the 4th of July, I saw Philando. I was actually, you know, happy. I'm actually, it's the 4th of July, so I'm trying to crash somebody's barbecue. And I see Philando, and I'm like, you know what? I haven't seen him because it's summer. What you doing this summer when I'm working at Chelsea Heights? Man, what the heck are you doing working? You know, in the position that Philando has with the district, they get the summer off with pay. So I'm thinking, what the heck are you doing? And the type of person that Philando is, he said to me, man, I love the kids. I'm just in conversation with my friend, and I'm having no idea that this is the last conversation I would ever have.
Well, it's so telling that, you know, he was talking about wanting to be with the kids still. I'm reading an article in the Huffington Post about, you know, the kids at this school. It's titled, The 395 Kids Philando Castile Left Behind. Everybody loved Mr. Phil, as they called him. And one woman tells of her grade school daughter at the Montessori Magnet School, telling her that I guess Philando Castile used to high-five all the kids as they came into the cafeteria. Mm-hmm. And the daughter was doing imaginary high-fives in the air, hoping that Mr. Phil would come back.
You know what I said to Phil? I said, Phil, man, get out of here, man. Those kids, man, they give us hell. So get out of here with that I love the kids mess. And he said, JT, man, I love everybody. And I went home with my day, and we celebrated. I didn't think those would be the last words that I would ever hear Philando say to me. It was, I love everybody. He said, I love everybody. He meant he loved everybody. Everybody. For him to take my friend from me like that, he loved everybody. You know, he used to go in his pockets, and kids couldn't afford lunch, and he would pay for their lunch out of his own pocket. And that was against school policy. And I mean, kids can't afford lunch right now. They miss Mr. Phil at their school. They miss him. I miss my friend. They let this officer get off with murder. Like, he murdered my friend. And they dragged him out of his car like a dog. And we get nothing. I'm sorry. Man, if I'm messing up your interview, I'm sorry. But I miss my friend.
John Thompson.
Actually found out that in the midst of all of this stuff, that a lot of times I've been like an advocate for change here in Minnesota. So a lot of times I go to these legislative hearings, I go to these city council meetings, I go to these listening sessions, and I was just trying to find out, like, who the hell is responsible for letting things like this happen. So I've told them, from this point on, like, I'll cry, I'll cry, I'll be sad, but from this point on, I'll be a regular fixture there. I've started the Fight for Justice LLC. I've started, we were part of the Philando Castile Relief Foundation. So we'll be there at the Capitol lobbying for allies to help us fight these bills and these laws that help officers use the catchphrase, I'm in fear for my life. But I know that we can't allow this to keep happening because, I mean, this can't be the narrative for African-American men this summer. What they showed me this summer, I mean, just a few weeks, last week, what they showed me that it's okay to shoot an African-American man as long as you have that catchphrase, I'm in fear for my life, you will get off. That's what they showed me. So I'm going to fight. And from here on, like, I'll cry, I'll be sad. But from this point on, for the rest of my life, I've dedicated my life to fighting for Philando. Like, I speak Philando, I eat Philando, I breathe Philando out of my breath. From this point on, you will not, on my watch, there will never be another Philando here in Minnesota.
That's John Thompson, a friend of the late Philando Castile. They worked together in the St. Paul public school system. John, thank you.
Thank you.
So, there's a lot of pain in the Twin Cities. Pride Parade officials have asked the first openly lesbian police chief of Minneapolis to minimize police participation in this Sunday's parade because of the Castile verdict. And we'll be reaching out to supporters of the local police who say they've had to remove stickers supporting law enforcement because of taunts.
A judge has temporarily halted the deportation of more than 100 Iraqis living in the Detroit area. They've argued they'll face torture, even death, if they're sent back to Iraq. Most are Christians, some are Muslim. U.S. District Judge Mark Goldsmith said yesterday that he'll decide in 2 weeks if his court has jurisdiction to hear their case. The Justice Department argues that he does not, and that these cases need to be heard in an immigration court. Immigration officials said the Iraqis have criminal convictions and deportation orders from an immigration judge. An attorney representing some of the Iraqis said, quote, when your life is on the line, each day is a victory. We'll continue to follow this story. Meanwhile, last year, more than 96,000 refugees came to the U.S., many of them children. They've been resettled in communities across the country, and one of those places is New Haven, Connecticut, where more than 270 refugee kids have just finished their first year in an American school. These children face many challenges, including a new culture and a new language, but educators hope an after-school music class can help them adapt to their new world. Diane Orson from Here Now contributor WNPR reports.
On a recent weekday afternoon at Fairhaven K-8 school, regular classes are over and it's time for violin class to begin. A girl is leading her peers in the helicopter game. They're practicing how to place a violin bow on the string.
Helicopter up.
She gently brings the bow down.
Landing.
And it's time to start making music. Students in this class range in age from 8 to 14, and all are refugees from Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Somalia. Their teacher turns now to a technique called pizzicato. As the children pluck the open strings on their instruments, she begins to play a tune. Teacher Yaida Matyakubova is a senior resident musician with Music Haven. The program provides free musical instruments, one-on-one lessons, and group ensemble coaching, plus trips to concerts, all without charge, to more than 75 low-income students in New Haven. Matyakubova says the idea for this class began when Music Haven students learned that refugee families were being resettled in New Haven.
When we heard about refugees fleeing from their homeland, going by foot, trying to escape the war zone, the conversation was brought up in our class. And initially, the kids are the ones who started the idea of wanting to meet the refugees and possibly play music for them.
My name is Nurhan, and I am 12 years old, and I am from Iraq.
How long have you been here?
1 year. I like music and I like to play with the instruments.
And tell me about your teacher.
I love her. She is smiling. Even we are making mistakes, she is smiling.
The program aims to help refugee children make new connections. It may also help them academically, psychologically, and socially. James Catterall is emeritus professor at UCLA and director of the Centers for Research on Creativity.
Children who get involved in music in elementary school and middle school tend to really like it. Music is a social event in the lives of these kids, and it becomes a reason to come to school.
Music also inspires ways of thinking in the brain, says Catterall, that involves spatial reasoning.
Spatial reasoning is important in mathematics and science, and perhaps surprisingly, it's even important in language.
That's the case for 14-year-old Ahmad Al-Zouabi from Syria.
I like to play violin because you can learn more English and everything.
Ahmad, his sister Noor, and their family recently arrived in New Haven. Noor says her brother practices his violin diligently.
Every day I listen for him because I think the music language, all the world understand this language. So I very like that my brother learn violin or learn anything about music.
Back in class, Yaida Matikubova encourages her students to sing.
Now I said to take a ball, one and two and three, das ha!
Matikubova was born in Uzbekistan and came to the U.S. at age 16 with a backpack and her violin. She says she understands the kinds of social challenges these young people face.
And when I first came here, I didn't know the language, and I didn't know the culture, and it took me some time to learn, and I find that through music, it brings us together, and we can really embrace and rely on that in the times when it's more difficult.
Matya Kubova says she hopes the classes will help to instill in these young refugees a love of music, a feeling of belonging, and a greater sense of confidence about their place in the world. For Here and Now, I'm Diane Orson.
And this program note, back in 2004, NPR's Claudio Sanchez followed 5-year-old Sam Marcenison to his first day of kindergarten. It was an emotional day for him and his parents. And now, almost 13 years later, another emotional day as he graduates from high school. This afternoon on All Things Considered, we'll catch up with him and see how it's all turning out. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.